Welcome to the Poetry Bath with me, Sian Thomas. In this episode, I will be meeting Rebecca Tomash, London-based poet, author of three pamphlets, and also now a full collection, which was published in 2019. And it absolutely blew me away. So yes, I hope you enjoy Rebecca's poems. Tomash, it is an absolute joy to welcome you to the Poetry Bath.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Well, Rebecca, I first came across your collection, which when it was published in, remind me of the year, please.
I believe 2019.
Okay. And it was the Poetry Book Society choice, I think, for that quarter, I believe that's right.
It was a Poetry Society recommendation.
Ah, so that's why I must have seen it and thought, oh, that looks good.
Oh, nice to hear.
And I absolutely loved it.
Thank you.
And it delighted and excited me in equal measure and alarmed as well. It's also in a very alarming collection. And so I have been really looking forward to getting together with you today to talk about it.
That's really kind. It's nice that it has had a kind of relatively long life. You know, it's kind of lovely that people are still interested in talking about a book that was published a few years ago, you know, as it should be, but that's not always the kind of way that we think about publishing. So yeah, I appreciate the chance to kind of think about it.
Good. So could you tell us first then, please, about, because one of the things that first struck me about the book is the look of it. It's a very distinctive look. It's written, the word witch is written in capital letters, and it's on this beautiful flesh pink, lurid pink cover, with this wonderful picture of the devil cavorting with witches upside down. Can you start there, please?
Sure. So, I mean, when it comes to the cover, excuse me, really all credit has to go to Tom Chivers, my editor at Penned in the Margins, who published the book. But it's a kind of interesting story. Tom was working with someone who was providing, you know, covers for a lot of Penned in the Margins books, but for whatever reason, the covers that this person was kind of bringing forward, which were visually interesting, didn't seem to match the spirit of the book. And we both really felt that in different ways. And, you know, I hope it's okay to, you know, obviously without naming any names, but I think Tom got to the point where he thought, you know what, I'm going to have a shot at this myself, because I think we both had such a clear vision that the cover somehow felt almost more important with this book than some others, because I think you need some kind of sort of nudge or signposting into the sort of intensity of the book's atmosphere, or that's how we both felt. So Tom basically designed it himself very close to when the book's going to be published and did an absolutely amazing job. My only real contribution, apart from approving it, was the colour. So I just knew from sort of the beginning of the process of writing it that I needed the cover to be pink. It was this kind of knowledge that you have before you can even express quite why it's relevant. Obviously, it's a feminist book. It's a book about female and female identified experience. That's often associated with pink, but it also kind of went beyond that. And as you said, fleshly pink, you know, it represents the feminist aspect, but it also represents the kind of bodily aspect as well. So, you know, Tom did run through some other potential colors, but I kind of kept saying, please pink, please pink. And, you know, one of the joys of working with an independent small publisher is you can have that really close relationship and collaboration, and he came around to it through our conversations, and yeah, the cover was born, and I was incredibly happy with it, and I'm happy with it to this day. It's beautiful.
It is really beautiful, yes, and really striking. You don't forget it. Could you give us a poem to kick us off,
Of
please?
course. So I thought that I might start with the first poem, basically, which is a slightly longer one, but I think, for those of your listeners who haven't read the book, it might be kind of a good starting point. But it is just worth really quickly saying that the book does follow a central character. There's an element of narrative. It focuses on this kind of witch character. So some of the poems fit into that narrative, and other poems, which are spell poems, are kind of divorced from that narrative. So this is one that is slightly separate because it's a hex, which is part of a kind of spell series. So it sort of stands alone outside of the witch's main narrative. Okay. Penis hex. The hex for a penis isn't really all about the penis. The penis is not an issue, all fine, doing its own thing, ink blot semen, sweet white plaster, pale peach tartlet. But when it goes, you see a lot of things. To hex a penis off means taking a laugh out for a walk, long and blue, cold as Russia, laughing and laughing, your mouth is open. Let your girlfriend see your tongue. To hex a penis off, wrap yourself up in a warm bed and no one is there. Intellectual persuasion, hand like steel between leg and a section of empty sky. Hex like Artemisia, Holofernes, head back the fucking sucker, head back and tirades full of blood. He goes down, way, way down. Judith's painted hand is a snare. She is catching your penis and taking it home. Hex with a plate of grilled pears against cream, a glass of just pink wine. Teacups, porcelain thrush egg blue, your soft under the breath singing. Hex it off with a little journey, islands of any kind, ideally somewhere cold, green things butting out into a black grey sea. No one is on the island to tell you the kind of things you should be doing. Hex at a child wedding. Don't worry, it's cool. At the ceremony, just wait until the drinks are being served, then set fire to the whole place. The drapes that are azure blue, holiday destination blue, Pope Innocent blue. The child bride comes with you, her big gobstopper eyes and Hello Kitty backpack full of dicks. Hex in a philosophy seminar. See them start to detach and waver a few centimeters apart from their owners. I don't know. Maybe I'm not actually bothered by the logical summation of things, their soft and sweet calculation and steadfast rationale. Maybe I like it out here in the dark, cold wood, with all my bits hanging down and fiery creatures perching on every surface, shaking their claws. Maybe I like it with God holding my sweaty, wavering hand. Hex it by saying nothing. This is a navy zip up and scarf that says, I understand comfort and solidarity. Don't talk to me. Don't tell me about your day or ask me where the good places are. Is there a problem in this sector? No. Off it goes. Turn back and unpave the roads. Hex an epic poem, some kind of discharge, a throne that you forge from gold and diamonds and plastic bangles and crow feathers and infinity rings. Hex it through glory, total and utter glory. Your huge red black hair reaching and touching the upper echelons, pagan understanding and all types of weird singing. Some woman in a mint silk pantsuit, so happy with a penis between her legs and the neck shucking it off, able to do exactly as is necessary. Wind batters the tall, insane skyscrapers, glowering, hungry sky, very unusual. That metallic taste in your mouth, it's changing, you see.
Wow, it's just wonderful. It's just so packed with joy and naughtiness and outrage and it makes me think. I think of the French feminism, of course, with it as well. The whole idea of the écriture féminine, and that idea of writing against Logos and against the patriarchy. And could you expand upon that, please, Rebecca?
In terms of what you just said,
Yeah, in terms of what
yeah.
I just said.
So I think what's kind of interesting for me is the writing of this book sort of happened at the same time that I was sort of engaging in these conversations with other people as well, around exactly what you're talking about in terms of the relationship between pushing back against patriarchy, but also pushing back against logos, against, rationality, not wholly, of course, but rationality is this kind of totalitarian sort of, Western Enlightenment rationality that sort of allows no other. And I, for example, around this period, I co-edited a collection called Spells, Occult Poetry for the 21st Century with the amazing Sarah Shin, for Ignota. And a lot of those conversations fed into that book as well. And I suppose the point of saying this is just, I feel like this poem was kind of written partly out of those sort of conversations that I was having with other thinkers and poets. And this feeling that I think was shared and is shared by many, which is that when we write, as you say, like the sense of what would feminist writing or what would a women's writing or a female identified writing look like? And obviously that's a capacious question, which doesn't have a simple answer. But I think one element of it is the ability, it's nothing biological, but just the kind of cultural sort of allowance that sort of female identified people have to question logic and rationality and to actually ask whether it's not being used as a form of kind of blunting of all kinds, a blunting of revolution, a blunting of communication with the non-human world and nature, a blunting of our sensuality and our ability to connect and so on and so forth, and it's such a kind of central part, I think, of all types of kind of historical and sort of capitalist oppression. So obviously that was all in my mind in a big way, but then obviously you have to turn it into poems, which is a kind of complicated process. And I think with this poem, that's massively in there, obviously. It's that pushback, as you say, against a kind of rationality which sort of squeezes out mystery and squeezes out kind of personal freedom, especially for women. But it's also a poem which allows anger in. And I think that's also a really important part for me of like pushing back against that kind of rationality, partly because, and again, trying to sort of sum up these concepts in a few sentences, but I think I certainly didn't want to take the position in the poem of this kind of male-female binary, where it's sort of female irrationality, softness, niceness, as opposed to sort of male rationality and control. Partly because I think it's disempowering, but I also think it's inaccurate and simplified. So I think it was important for me to kind of have both elements in there, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely, and I love the way that you begin by letting the penis have fun.
Yes. Totally. And I was quite inspired by there were sort of representations in kind of medieval times of witches and penis trees, which I'm sure you've come across, where they were sort of like kind of agriculturally tending to these trees. And they're really funny because they're often sort of images which are in these sort of treatises, which are deeply misogynistic. But the actual image is like very sweet and kind of nice looking, and they're having a good time. And I sort of really enjoyed the playfulness of that. So some of that came into the poem.
We talked, we met very, very briefly a few years ago at the amazing symposium on Hexing the Patriarchy, in Manchester at Manchester University, and I think I asked you a question about your use of humour and carnival as a way of subverting the status quo, the patriarchy, the logos, and so. Yes, I mean that, which kind of also, yeah, all of that. So humor, your use of humor is, and you, I guess, it's, talk to me about that, Rebecca.
Gosh, I mean, yeah, it's humor's a funny one because obviously, on the one hand, I think certainly when I'm writing, of course, I have a sense of where I'm trying to get to in terms of, I have some ideas or some feelings or whatever it might be that's kind of sparked off the writing of the poem. I don't think I've ever sort of very, very consciously sat down and said to myself, Rebecca, you must make this poem funny. Partly because I think that would just be crushing and I would feel stage fright, but also So in a way, it comes into it. But also at the same time, of course, you draw on particular threads of your practice for particular projects. You know, at the moment, I'm just finishing up my second book of poetry, and that doesn't lack humour, but I think there's more here. And I think the reason is exactly as you kind of rightly point out, it is connected to that kind of carnivalesque element, that almost jester element where you use humour to kind of push back at these very rigid and sometimes scary sort of power bases. So that's part of it. Of course, it's a way, you know, obviously humor can be revolutionary, and it can be part, you know, to be able to mock something is also to be able to kind of bring it down. And of course, that is at the heart of this poem specifically, which I just read, because of course, the big kind of cliche fear, right, of the patriarchy is being sort of, you know, in some way emasculated by a woman. So obviously you sort of turn that into a kind of joke and you kind of laugh at that fear. At the same time, I also think part of this book was developed as part of a PhD, which I did at UEA, and my supervisor was Denise Riley, which was obviously a huge honour. And something Denise and I talked about was how sometimes when people are writing about sort of female victims from the past, be that someone specific like Joan of Arc, or be that women who were killed in the witch trials in Europe, there's an exploitative kind of sentimentality can come in. And I think I was very, very wary of that because, yes, I'm a woman, but really beyond that, you know, our experiences are of course not super comparable. And actually, I think in some ways, humour is about pushing back against that sense of sort of degradation as display. And if you keep it humorous, you kind of keep your voice and you keep the voices of the kind of characters, so to speak, in your poems, protected a little bit, I think, against that exploitation, or that's the aim anyway.
That's really interesting because I'm also, when you're talking about that and about your use of humour in a way in order to do that, that also one of the things that strikes me particularly in that poem and in some of the others as well is that you don't linger for very long on an image. You give us a very fast, a quick image, like the Hello Kitty backpack. What was it?
The Hello Kitty backpack full of dicks. Yeah.
yeah. It's yeah. So we get that very, and it's funny because of that, but it's also, it doesn't allow us to dwell. It doesn't allow us to become too comfortable gazing upon someone else's suffering.
Yes, I think that's absolutely, I'm glad that that's how it feels, because that's what I want to achieve. Obviously, I want to do justice to the experiences, you know, and I don't want to sort of undermine them or sweep them under the carpet. But at the same time, yes, I don't want to sit with anything that could become maudlin spectacle, because that just doesn't feel right. And obviously part of the challenge of writing this book is that it's a book about female oppression, partly historically, the witch trials, but also it's obviously wider than that as well. And it would be certainly inappropriate morally and artistically to try and kind of contain those experiences and think that I can represent them. And I think that partly leads to this slightly fragmented way of putting my ideas across. Because if you sit in a voice for too long, it's easier to feel that you're kind of taking ownership of it. And I really didn't want to do that.
Could you give us another poem, please, Rebecca?
Of course. So I'm going to do a much shorter one now, just to give you a little bit of a taste of one of the shorter spell poems. These poems sort of permeate the book and go throughout it. So this is one of those. So even though we are in February now and this will be coming out in March, it still feels like winter. So I thought it would be appropriate to read this poem for reasons you'll see. Spell for January. The two head calls to you. He is resting over a door and motioning you in and sending you out. Who will be on your list of the most ambitious fucks? Who will be on your list of the persons leaning towards disaster? I don't say don't buy. Just tip your head back like an eel is going in. The cold has something to say in its weak syllables. We will have achieved something when you get up and make coffee naked and you are not naked. We will have achieved something when everyone leans into the ugly gale and is properly afraid. That's it.
I love that double sense, that the double-headed figure of Janus. But also that there's again this idea of not not becoming too comfortable in any camp, that we need to remain detached in some way. We need to let things pass through us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even though in some ways that, the figure of Janus and, this sense of the double-headed figure isn't particularly connected to witchcraft, or anything like that. I mean, actually a lot of the spell poems go quite far away from that as a topic, which partly is just leaving it out. But I also think it's connected in the way that you say, because it's part of this kind of alternative to totalitarian rationality is that sense of flux, of openness, of porousness, of allowing the world and other people and ideas to kind of move through you, and a sort of moving away from sort of fixedness and rigidity, as I've said. So I think that's part of the reason that the poem felt like it kind of belonged in the world of this book.
Yeah, I think that really comes across. I loved the bit about, could you read those lines about the best fuck and the what was the line, and the line that followed it?
Yes, it just says, who will be on your list of the most ambitious fucks? Who will be on your list of the persons leaning towards disaster?
So it's that your most ambitious fucks, and then the person most leaning towards disaster, which is really interesting. That this is, it's not here necessarily about pleasure or pain or your own pleasure or pain. It's, oh, so you're doing some really interesting things there.
Thank you, Sean. I mean, yeah, it's a. I think often with these spell poems as well, what I really liked about writing them is that once you give yourself a topic, the kind of containment of that form of a spell, it really allows you to roam in a way that's very freeing. And I think these are by far the kind of strangest poems in the book. They're the most kind of leaning into almost like a mystic space. But actually, of course, that classic sort of paradox, it's having the confinement of saying this is a spell, of course, however you define that, relatively loosely defined, but still it's something there. It's a kind of container, knowing they were going to all be relatively short as well. Having that sort of formal container, I think it helped me to play on those kind of edges of meaning more easily.
I read a little quote from you in the Suburban Review, and you talked about your process, your practice, and I think this is going to, we're running out of time in the first episode, so I think this is probably going to spill over into a second one. But you said, when an idea or thought catches fire, I begin to write as quickly as possible before my own insecurities or doubts can catch up with me.
Yeah, I think that's still pretty true. And I think it's especially true when you're writing a certain type of poem where you have, as I've just described, those kind of loose constraints. Because it's oddly generative, but I think if you analyze it too much, it would turn into something a little bit, I don't know what the word would be, just a little bit kind of boring and potentially banal. Because obviously, if I was to kind of use my rational mind and sort of think, oh, what would a spell for January look like? You can sort of imagine, New Year and, whatever it might, and of course there are elements of that in the poem, but it could very easily, I think, become quite banal. So I think that's where that need for speed comes from. Because it's sort of like you have to let the unconscious mind and the conscious mind collaborate. And I'm sure that's a recognizable experience for many, many poets. It's not that I'm not thinking as I'm writing, it's not free writing, but I don't want to kind of spend too long worrying about the punctuation or whatever on my first draft for that reason. You don't want to kind of let the sort of judgment element come in too much. It is kind of has been my experience.
It also sounds as though, particularly with this collection, that again, thinking about the idea of breaking down, writing against logos, that it's particularly useful to work in a frenzied way.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the book took a long time to write, but that sort of each individual poem, definitely trying to write quickly, not edit too much as you go along, go back and do that work afterwards. It just absolutely kind of became the practice that this book needed. Because I think if you are going to write about the occult, you have to have the sort of courage to kind of lean into that place of irrationality and openness. I don't mean you have to actually engage in occult practice, you can, but I think it would be, yes, it would be sort of letting down the topic in a way to not try and engage in that type of writing. So that's what I tried to do. Didn't always work, but overall I was happy with that.
Been listening to the Poetry Bath with me, Sian Thomas, and my guest Rebecca Tomash. And I should also point out that it was another Rebecca, Rebecca Hurst, who introduced me to Rebecca's collection and not the Poetry Book Society. Our theme tune was composed and performed by Nigel Horn, and there will be more of my interview with Rebecca and more of Rebecca's wonderful work next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.